MacCast, Sunday, November 30th, 2014. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, those of you in the States, I hope you have thoroughly recovered from the food coma that we all enter after we have our Thanksgiving feast. Yeah, Thanksgiving was earlier in the week, and I definitely ate more than my fair share. But I think that happens commonly this time of year, right? Or I don't think I'm the exception. Probably one of the reasons, too, why we need Apple to quickly come out with the Apple Watch so we can turn on the fitness app and maybe get back into shape after the holidays. I always promise that I'm going to do that. But, you know, I just like food too much. I also like beer too much, which is another potential issue. But regardless, I have a great show for you today. Lots of things to talk about. And we don't have any sponsorships here at the top of the show this time. So we're just going to jump right into the Apple news. Kicking off things, I want to talk a little bit about Apple's manufacturing partners. It seems like they're tightening up production partners for the next generation of devices. We saw a story this week that Foxconn is planning to build a brand new display plant in southern Taiwan, spending $2.6 billion with their Innolux division, and it's supposedly to supply displays exclusively for Apple. A company representative spoke to Bloomberg, and they said that they will begin mass-producing panels exclusively for Apple by the end of 2015. Now, they didn't state specifically what the displays will be used for, what devices they're going to go in. But they did say that the factory came about because of a, quote, urgent request for exclusive capacity from Apple. Now, the technology group at Foxconn expects to employ about 2,300 people at the factory. And Innolux is Taiwan's largest maker of LCD screens. And it's believed that they currently supply the displays for the 4.7-inch Retina iPhone 6. Apple also has typically used other display manufacturers. They get displays from LG, Samsung, and Japan Display. So it's not an exclusive agreement, but it is a pretty big one. And it's believed that Apple's been trying to slowly work their way away from actually sourcing displays from Samsung, likely due to sort of the tenuous relationship they have, being a manufacturing partner as well as a competitor. We know they've been frenemies for a while, but it's looking like Apple is going to have a nice new display facility over there in Taiwan by the end of next year. And speaking of displays, some users are complaining that the glass on the new iPhone 6 models might not be up to snuff. We know Apple had been working, or we believed Apple had been working on trying to get Sapphire displays, and as we've talked about on previous episodes, we know that did not work out very well. We're going to get to a little bit more information about the relationship with GT Advanced here in a second. But Apple switched over. They're using glass panels, we would assume, from Corning. But Apple Insider is pointing to a thread over on Apple's discussion boards with over 103,000 views, 626 replies, that started up on September 23rd. So I'm sure there's actually more by the time you actually hear this. But in that thread, users are alleging that the current iPhone is much more prone to getting scratches than previous models. Now, each generation of iPhone should be getting progressively better and better in terms of the glass technology, and it's assumed that you would have better scratch resistant with the latest version. Apple doesn't actually reveal what material they're using, but as I said, it's believed to be Gorilla Glass 3 on the iPhone. We know last week Corning was out touting the properties of Gorilla Glass 4, which is supposed to be twice as resistant to breakage as the current generation. But Apple does call the current generation of glass on the iPhone 6 strengthened Ion X glass. So they're doing something to make it a lot stronger, a lot tougher. So it should be actually resisting scratches resisting breaking more. But one user claims that he's seeing scratches after his iPhone 6 had been carried around in just a microfiber case. I assume that means a sleeve. I have to wonder, though, you know, is it the kind of situation where you get some grit or you get some sort of material inside that case, and as you're carrying it around in your pocket, it's slowly rubbing and basically sanding the surface of the iPhone. Others have complained that the more rounded edges are getting scratched up because they don't have that extra protection being exposed on the edge. That's causing it to come in contact with more material, resulting in scratches on the edges of the phone. So far, me personally, I have my iPhone in just an Apple case. I have no screen protector, nothing on the front cover, just the Apple leather case. And I have had no issues so far. Now, I'm pretty careful about carrying my phone just in a pocket without any other material. So no keys, no coins, those sorts of things. But a number of folks in the discussion thread are also claiming that they've taken extreme care with the displays on their iPhone 6s, yet they're still becoming scratched. Now, Ion X glass or Gorilla Glass can get scratched if you apply the right material to it. It is not immune, especially to things like quartz or other hard substances. So depending upon what you have, you know, carrying around with your iPhone, it's certainly not immune. But is it more scratch prone than prior generations of the iPhone? I think that remains to be seen. We're going to kind of keep an eye and watch on this thread. I'd also be curious to hear from you. If you have an iPhone 6 or a 6 Plus, have you suffered any screen damage or scratches since getting your device? Like I said, I haven't personally, but I'd be curious to know if you have. Now let's talk about GT Advanced a little bit more. We've been talking about the fallout since they announced they are declaring bankruptcy, that they have had to pull out of their contracts basically with Apple, unable to supply the sapphire glass that Apple was requesting in the volume or quantities that Apple needed, which is a big reason why most of us believe we didn't see those displays on the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. Now the Wall Street Journal said that they spoke to Pegatron, another one of Apple's suppliers, to try and sort of get a sense of what it's like to be an Apple supplier or partner. Everybody's trying to just kind of figure out, you know, what went wrong with the GT Advanced deal. And it really looks like the gist of it is they overpromised and really couldn't deliver. And that seems to jive with what Pegatron told the Wall Street Journal. They said the general answer is being an Apple supplier, not easy. I don't think that's surprising to any of us, right? Could you imagine working with Apple at that level? But they did note, if you can, it can reap big rewards for your company. They describe Apple as a partner who is tough but fair. And, you know, as GT Advance is alleging that Apple was not fair to them, we are hearing from other partners and suppliers that generally, yeah, they do. They, you know, they kind of hold up their end of the bargain, but they're not going to let you slide on things. Pegatron says the keys to success with Apple are not promising more than you can deliver and also diversifying your sales, basically going to other companies, not making Apple your exclusive partner, not putting all of your eggs in one basket. Apple really can't be your own option. And these are both areas where it seems in the reports and the information that's leaking out now that GT Advance made some big errors in judgment. So Apple is known for being very strict, very demanding, especially on things like quality. And GT Advance had promised things like sapphire boules sized at 578 pounds, basically double the size of anything that was being produced. That would have yielded, could they have pulled it off, panels that would have been viable likely for the iPhone 6, 6 Plus, for actual iPhone displays. We know that didn't happen, and now we're seeing the damage that can be done there. Now, luckily, Apple has come out. They're supposedly working with the state of Arizona to try and repurpose the factory that was built there in Arizona, and hopefully they'll be able to do something with it that can regenerate the 700-plus jobs that were left over there. The whole thing's kind of a mess and a big disaster, and I'm sure there's going to be continuing lawsuits, so more information to talk about. But just in general, you know, if you're going to go into business with Apple, you probably should go in with your eyes wide open and know that they are going to be very strict about their agreements. They're going to be very demanding about their quality, And they're not going to really take no for an answer when you can't deliver. Now, that's not to say that Apple isn't immune from some quality issues themselves. Those of us who have been working with iOS 8 as well as OS X Yosemite know that things can ship that are a little bit buggy. The 10.10.1 Yosemite update came out a few weeks ago, and while it's fixed issues for a number of people, it certainly hasn't fixed everything. And the good news is that not long after they released that update to the public, Apple did push out OS X Yosemite 10.10.2 beta to developers. The build number is 14C68K, and it did not specify or list any specific areas for developers to test, but I think many are hoping that it might finally address their Wi-Fi issues, which seem to continue to be an issue for many, despite the fact that the 10.10.1 update was supposed to fix it. Now, if you're impacted, you're likely experiencing issues where your Wi-Fi connection will start to become very slow or highly unstable and then possibly start dropping out every few minutes to the point where you have no Wi-Fi at all. I've also heard reports from a few of you that you're also experiencing networking issues even when on Ethernet, so I'm not sure exactly how far this extends. And it's been a bit tricky figuring out what the common thread is, like who gets impacted by this, because I've also heard reports from many of you that you're having absolutely no issues and that the OS X Yosemite upgrade has gone completely fine for you. But for those of you who are impacted by the networking problems, at least one user seems to claim to know exactly what the root cause is, and it's something that would impact both iOS 8 as well as Mac OS X. And I've had the issue for sure on my iOS 8 devices where I'm having to actually go flip them into airplane mode, disconnect them from the network, and flip it back on to kind of get my networking back. But this information comes from the co-founder and CEO of a Colorado Springs-based networking company called Quantum Metric. His name is Mario Chibara, and he thinks the issues are related to Apple's use of Bonjour over the Apple Wireless Direct Link protocol, or AWDL. And that's technology that's used for things like AirDrop and AirPlay, also your gaming connections. So think of things like gaming controllers, or actually more specifically, I think, peer-to-peer gaming. So if you're doing gaming directly from iOS device to iOS device. And so what he did was he wrote his findings up over at Medium, and I will try to have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to read all the technical nitty-gritty. But basically, he says if you disable AirDrop and AirPlay and those services that rely on Apple Wireless Direct Link within the operating system, then that seems to fix the issue. Now, unfortunately, on iOS devices, in order to do that, it would require a jailbreak. But for Mac OS X, there's actually a little terminal hack you can run. The problem, obviously, is, though, once you've disabled that, you no longer have features like AirDrop or any kind of peer-to-peer stuff. You're not going to be able to do your AirPlay, which those are features that I really like. I wouldn't want to have to disable those in my operating system. So I don't think this is a long-term fix, but at least it points to a potential source of the trouble, something that maybe hopefully Apple will look into and can incorporate maybe in this latest 10.10.2 update for Yosemite and the next update for iOS. Now, it's not likely coming in the 10.10.2 update, and I think some folks hope this update never comes, but we're starting to hear once again that Apple may be looking at switching the default browser in Safari away from Google. It's understood that Google's search deal with Apple is set to expire sometime in early 2015, and the site The Information is now reporting that Apple's Internet Software Services Senior Vice President Eddie Q is actually talking to Microsoft and Yahoo about potentially becoming the default search engine inside Safari. There's also speculation that Apple could switch to other non-Google search engines in countries outside the U.S. The report, I don't think, listed specifically what companies Apple was talking to globally, but the idea, I think, would be to have more regional search engine, to have a more regional search engine as the default in certain countries. Right now, Siri and Spotlight suggestions are already powered by Bing, so personally, I haven't noticed that being that big of a deal. The results that I get from Siri, the results that I get from Spotlight seem to be pretty good. Apple's also partnered with other services, obviously, for Siri and Spotlight, things like Wikipedia and other kinds of results, so you kind of get that universal search anyway. I think this is more about the information and the content. I also think that as long as Apple doesn't remove Google entirely as an option, I'm not so sure that I care too much what my default search engine is when I first install the browser. If I can go in and change it back to Google, that's going to be fine for me. I think that's going to be fine for most power users. I think the deal is that where Apple can make more money in a partnership, get a better deal with a company like Microsoft or Google, or Yahoo, that's better for their business. And it makes sense that they would be looking into that. Also, Google, to a certain degree, again, like Samsung, is somewhat of a frenemy, right? Apple has to partner with them on certain services, but they still have the Android operating system, which is their biggest competitor in the mobile space. So if Apple can switch over, get a better deal from Microsoft, better deal from Yahoo. And it's interesting that they're talking to Microsoft and Yahoo, in my opinion, because actually Microsoft bought Yahoo's search business years ago. So they really are the power behind the Yahoo search now. To me, they seem almost one and the same, although they are still run as separate products. So again, I don't know if I'd really care. I'd be curious to know what you think. But I think if Apple can get a better deal, if they can make more money, have a tighter relationship with Microsoft or Yahoo as opposed to Google, and that's what's best for their business, it makes sense for them to do. If you're concerned about privacy and things like that, you already have other search engine options like DuckDuckGo. And I've started to use that, and I've been very impressed with the DuckDuckGo service. What's great about that is they don't sell any of your information. They don't do any tracking. They don't make their money off that part of the search. So if you're concerned about privacy, you might look into that. And with Safari, we've always had the option to switch our default browser. So again, if they don't take that away, I don't think this is a big deal. And long term, it might be best for Apple from a business standpoint. So I think it makes sense. Over the past few episodes, we've been talking about Apple's new A8 and A8X processors. Once Apple releases a new processor, you know that information starts to come out as different organizations get their hands on them, put them through speed tests. So, you know, be it Anontech or Tom's Hardware, all these places, they start to analyze the chips and look at them. And every once in a while, new information will come out because of things that I think ingenious software developers are doing. And that happened this past week. Softorino, they're the developers of a new app called Walter that is really cool. It's this media uploading app. As a matter of fact, I ran across it over on the Mac Observer. They did a little write-up of it. And it's an app that lets you take almost any media file, any video file, any audio file on your Mac and upload it, or basically transfer it directly onto your iOS device. So what you do is you plug in your Lightning cable, your USB to Lightning cable, dock your phone, and then you fire up Walter, and you can drop any audio or video file on there, and it will, I think, convert it to an iPhone-compatible format and then transfer it into the native apps on your Mac. So you can basically bypass iTunes using Walter, but still, once you've thrown in your video, it will go into the video sections on your iPhone, or if it's a audio file, it will go into your iTunes library on your iPhone. So you can take something like an Ogg Vorbis file, for example, or you can take an MKV file, throw it on there, and it will make it iPhone compatible and stick it on your device. So really cool stuff. But they were working on their software, and they discovered some new secrets inside Apple's A8 on the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. What they learned was basically the A8 is capable of playing back 4K video. Using their app, they found it was possible to load 4K videos onto an iPhone 6. And not only that, the device was actually able to play back that video without any issues. So a 4K image is 3840 by 2160 pixels. And of course, the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus screens are 1334 by 750 and 1920 by 1080 pixels, respectively. So It could play back the video. You're not going to see 4K video on your devices, so there's really no point ultimately in doing it. But it still shows the promise of Apple's chips being able to play back 4K video, which could be useful for things like a next generation Apple TV, maybe based on an A8 processor, or say if you're going to use your iPhone connected to a 4K display to actually playback and run 4K video. So the possibility is there. The chip seems to be capable of doing it. And we know that the next generation chips are probably already in the works. So who knows what they're going to be able to do. But those A8 or AX series processors from Apple are amazing chips. Apple's doing the design in-house, and they're able to really push things to the limits. And this is just another example of that, something that was pretty cool and showed up this week. So I'd encourage you to check out the Walter software if you get a chance. I think it's pretty cool stuff, and I will try to have a link to it again in the show notes at maccast.com. Apple's iPhone 6 and 6 Plus had only been on sale for a couple weeks when they announced their last quarterly numbers. That would be Apple's fourth fiscal quarter, or the third quarter of the year for you and me. Well, Ming-Chi Kuo, the analyst at KGI Securities, expects that iPhone shipments in the fourth quarter are going to show massive year-over-year quarterly growth. He's expecting iPhone shipments, to grow a whopping 82% in the fourth quarter. His prediction is that Apple will have shipped over 71.5 million iPhones, and that roughly 41.65 million of those, a little less than 60%, will be iPhone 6s. Interestingly, he doesn't think that the 6 Plus is showing signs of weak demand. Rather, he's saying that it has strong demand, but Apple has had supply chain issues, so they haven't been able to sell as many or ship as many as they had hoped. Thus, the numbers are a little bit lower than the iPhone 6. He also feels that Apple's ability to manage the supply chain issues as they finish out the quarter could have a direct impact on the final sales numbers. So there could be a little bit of a shift in that sales percentage, iPhone 6 to 6 Plus, depending on how Apple does with sort of shoring up iPhone 6 Plus shipments. They seem to be doing a little bit better, so they may sell a few more units here in the holiday quarter, and that could adjust those figures. Now, moving into the first quarter of 2015, Kuo says he does expect to see a significant off-season slowing of iPhone demand, with unit shipments dropping to 49.4 million units. Interestingly, though, in the fourth quarter, he sees quarter-on-quarter growth of 77.3% and 58.2% for the iPhone 5C and the 4S, respectively. So while total iPhone sales are going to slow, he is seeing quarter-on-quarter growth of the lower-priced offerings from Apple, the iPhone 5C and 4S. And that is interesting because even with their growth, he expects Apple to cease production on both of those phones sometime during the year. And that speculation was propped up by another report from the Commercial Times, who said that Apple will stop producing iPhone 5C and 4S sometime the middle of next year. Now, keep in mind, though, even if Apple stops iPhone 5C production, they're still going to have a lot of inventory and channel stuff that they're going to have to clear out. So if they're killing it off in the middle of next year toward, you know, end of spring, something like that, they're still going to have inventory to sell through the summer until likely they announce the next generation iPhone, which I think most of us would expect to be the iPhone 7, and there could be some new lower priced offering to replace that. I'm not really sure what that might be, whether it'll be an iPhone 6C or a 7C, or if it's going to just simply be Apple moving to maybe the iPhone 5S being that entry level model that they're going to sell. But I think, in my opinion, they're not going to just phase out and stop selling the 5C without replacing it with some other offering. So I would fully expect if they do cease production that we'll see them sort of shifting the line around and still fulfilling that free or almost free end of the market. It's the entry level point. It's something Apple needs to do. The one hope that I have is that Apple will finally decide that 8 gigabytes, having an 8 gigabyte offering for a smartphone is ridiculous. I think they need to jump all the way to 32 gigabytes being the entry-level model. I think 16 doesn't even cut it, but I would expect likely when they switch the models around that they'll start out at 16 gigabytes for that free offering. Again, hope it doesn't happen, but that's likely what we will see. But for sure, over the past quarter, Apple's been seeing strong demand, strong sales of the iPhone 6 and the 6 Plus, the new larger screen devices. The one question and the one speculation that had been thrown out, I think also at the last quarterly results call, when we saw that iPad numbers were slowing and iPad sales were slowing, is the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, are those devices, because they're larger screen, are people using those in lieu of their iPads? Are we seeing some kind of iPad cannibalization? Is that something that's really happening? I think it's actually something that Tim Cook is aware of and probably felt was going to happen, but we're starting to see some data and numbers that seem to indicate that that may be the case. This latest data came from a post on the blog for the Pocket app. If you're not familiar with Pocket, this is an app that lets you take articles and save them for later, kind of like Instapaper, those sorts of things. You can come back and read longer form articles. They looked at over 2 million articles within their system, and the opens for those, both on video and articles, compared to before and after the release of the iPhone 6 Plus. And in their study, they looked at those users that had both an iPhone and an iPad. So they looked at the folks that had an iPhone 5S and an iPad before the release of the iPhone 6, and then they looked at those users when they had an iPhone 6 or 6 Plus along with that iPad, and they found some really interesting things. In their blog post, they said that 55% of owners of the iPhone 5S would view content on their phone rather than their iPad, but after those users upgraded to an iPhone 6 or 6 Plus, those numbers leapt up significantly. They saw that 72% of iPhone 6 owners would read content on their iPhone versus their iPad, while 80% of iPhone 6 Plus owners were reading Pocket content on their iPhone versus their iPad. The study also noted that those folks with bigger phones tended to read content more frequently on those devices. They saw that owners of iPhone 6 Pluses upped their iPhone reading 33%, while those who purchased an iPhone 6 Plus or upgraded to an iPhone 6 Plus were reading content on their iPhone 65% more frequently. There were some other interesting observations in the post. They noted that people consumed video more frequently once they had a larger phone, and also that iPads seemed to stay at home more frequently. So they were using their iPhones in lieu of taking the iPad with them when they were out and about. They did note, however, that iPads were still preferred in the late evenings. After 9 p.m., users were returning back to their iPads. So that sort of also props up the idea that maybe the iPads are becoming more of an at-home device. You're sitting on the couch, you're grabbing that when you're in bed next to the nightstand, and you're switching over, and that the iPhones are leaving the house and people are more willing to consume or read articles because of the larger screen display. They did note that it seemed iPhones were used less during morning commute times, 22% less, and they attributed that to what they called the one-hand dilemma, the fact that the larger screen devices couldn't be used with one hand. So maybe you're on the subway, you're on a train, you're having to hold on with one hand to the strap, and now you can't use your phone. I found that part of the article to be a little bit of a stretch. They're making a lot of assumptions about what people may or may not be doing. I'm thinking maybe people aren't reading in the car. I'd be curious to know if those numbers were before, you know, comparing the before and after. I think they actually were in the study. The other things that they noticed was that Pocket users seemed to prefer the iPhone 6 2.5 times more than the iPhone 6 Plus. So they saw 2.5 times more iPhone 6s versus 6 Pluses, and that seems to jive with some of the other numbers we had been reading, that the iPhone 6 is outselling the iPhone 6 Plus 3-1. Now, we can speculate on why that might be. I think that falls in line with what I felt would happen, that there'd be an initial rush of demand for the iPhone 6 Plus, and then as things panned out, more customers would be opting for the iPhone 6. Some people are speculating, though, also that just because of availability on the iPhone 6 Plus, some users are having to opt for the iPhone 6 because they just can't get the larger screen iPhone. And one thing to bear in mind about this study, as we're talking about the numbers, is that it does just come from one company looking at, you know, behavior right after the new devices are released. So it could just be infatuation with the new device. It's the thing that you're using more frequently. I know that that happens to me. Still, I found the numbers very interesting just based on my own experience since upgrading to the iPhone 6 Plus. I am finding that I'm leaving my iPad behind more frequently and that I am consuming more content, be it emails or surfing the web or even using the Pocket app on my iPhone 6 Plus. Now, I don't know if that trend will continue or not. The other thing that I wanted to talk about, and I don't remember if I brought this up on the last show, is that for me personally, what I've learned is that I think I preferred the old method where I was actually carrying around two devices, taking my iPhone 5S with me along with my iPad. Now that I'm exclusively taking my iPhone 6 Plus, I'm finding, yes, I am using it like an iPad, but I'm also finding that like an iPad, because it's so large, I'm not able to keep it and carry it around in my pocket like as frequently as I like. So I have it out more frequently, and I don't know if that's impacting my usage. I don't know if I have this trend because it's in my hand to use it more frequently, to read stuff more frequently. In the past, what I'd do is I'd have my iPad in my bag, and I would pull that out, and then I could leave my phone safely tucked away in my pocket. I feel like if I have to have a device out anyway, I'd rather have the even larger screen of my iPad with me and keep my iPhone in my pocket for more phone-like things. So in the past, my usage was on the phone to do phone calls, to maybe do Twitter, maybe do some light web surfing, surf the App Store, those sorts of things. And then when I wanted to actually take notes or read articles, that's when I would turn to my iPad. Now I'm doing all of that on my iPhone, but I don't know that I fully like that experience, at least not with the trade-off of having this large device in my pocket that's a little bit more cumbersome to carry around. It seems to me, and I don't know if this makes sense, that if I'm going to have a larger, cumbersome device on me at the same time as I have my iPhone, I'd rather have two devices versus just one. And maybe I'm the exception to the rule. So I'm curious, are you using your iPad less since upgrading to a larger screen iPhone? And if you're an iPhone 6 Plus user, do you have any remorse over opting for that versus, you know, the option of maybe carrying two devices around like I've been experiencing? Shoot me some feedback. Let me know, maccast@gmail.com. We were able to get a little bit more information about Apple's upcoming Apple Watch this week because Apple pushed a few updates to the Apple Watch mini site. So if you go there, you'll see they expanded out a couple of the areas on the features page. They originally had just one features page that kind of covered timekeeping, the different ways to connect, and health and fitness. Those have now been broken out into separate sections. And along with that, they've expanded out some of the content. For example, in the timekeeping section, they now have names and descriptions of all of the different watch faces, so you can kind of browse through those. They also have multiple looks for many of the watch faces that have more levels of detail if you'd like. So, for example, some of the faces you can go in and maybe you just want to show the minutes, but you can also turn on then seconds or maybe even milliseconds, additional information. There's also options for doing what is called complications. And this is actually a horology term, a timekeeping term, something that the watch industry uses, not an Apple term. But basically what quote-unquote complications are those additional specialized functions that might show up on the watch face. So traditionally, those would be things like maybe it shows the moon phases or the times for sunrise and sunsets. All of those things are examples of complications. Well, with the Apple Watch, you're going to be able to have some additional more tech-oriented complications, things like stock quotes or the current weather, maybe your next upcoming calendar event or different kinds of notifications. Daily activity information, all of those complications are going to be available, and it kind of goes into details about what those are and what they will look like on the updated website. The timekeeping section also has a new interactive demo of the stopwatch feature, which is interesting, and the stopwatch has a couple different options. You can have a digital version, an analog version, or there's also a hybrid version, and as you're playing through the demo, you can kind of switch between each one of those and kind of get a sense of what the interface will look like. So it's pretty cool to be actually to be able to kind of see how the Apple Watch is going to work and function before it actually hits the streets. And by the same token, they expanded out the Ways to Connect section. It goes now into more detail about several of the things that they talked about during the keynote announcement, things like messages, the Sketch application where you can actually draw an image and send it to another Apple Watch, the tap functionality, which uses that taptic feedback to send a vibration notification to someone so you can tap out a song, or you could tap out a little message if you know Morse code, I assume, and it would be felt on the person that's watch that you were sending it to. And of course, the heartbeat feature where you can actually record your actual heartbeat and send that to someone else as a taptic touch response to their watch. And they also updated and provided some more detail in the health and fitness section, including adding new interactive animations that show how the Apple Watch's move, exercise, and stand monitoring functions are going to work. So you can kind of see in the UI animated how those fitness applications are going to work and integrate with the fitness app on your iOS device. And if you remember, Apple released the Apple Watch Kit software development kit to developers a couple weeks ago. That revealed some other information about how early applications are going to work on the watch. But just to summarize, you're not going to be able to have fully native third-party applications on the Apple Watch until later in 2015. What you are going to get on release day are updates to apps that use extensions running on the iPhone to actually pass data to the different kinds of interfaces on the Apple Watch. And there's three options available to developers. One would be actionable notifications. So these are notifications that come up and then you'll be able to interact and tap with them. You're going to have the glances to actually relay and display information. And then you'll have WatchKit apps, which basically interact with the directly with the app that is on the phone. There's still no additional details with the website update on price points or release date. We do know that the Apple Watch is going to start at $349 US. And right now, the best guess as to a release date is sometime in the spring of 2015. And that came about, you know, Apple prior to this had been saying sometime early 2015. So we didn't know if that was first quarter or second quarter. But if you remember, Apple's Senior Vice President Angela Arendt, Senior Vice President of Retail, made comments to her staff that seemed to indicate that we would see the watch toward sometime in the spring of 2015. So stay tuned. As more information comes out, we'll talk about it. But it's looking right now spring for the Apple Watch. And until then, you can kind of see what the experience might be like over on Apple's Apple Watch website, which they seem to be continuing to update. Hopefully, they'll continue to add more and more information as we get closer to release. And then finally, in the news for this week, we have some more updates on the supposed 12-inch iPad. This time around, the information is coming from a Japanese magazine called MacFan. They published what they claim to be possible schematics for what they're calling the iPad Air Plus. I think in the past, we've kind of heard most people refer to the 12-inch iPad as the iPad Pro or iPad Air Pro. So the name difference is something new in the MacFan article, and news of the MacFan article and the images came via Mac Atakara, and they've been a good source for Apple leaks in the past. I had not heard of MacFan before, but when I was reading some of the reports, MacFan, I guess, has previously reported some accurate details about the iPhone 6 screen, so there is some legitimacy to their rumors. Now, if you're like me, we've been hearing rumors about this 12-inch iPad for years, so you're immediately a little bit skeptical. You're going, well, what's new in this one? Well, this time around, they claim to have a schematic, very detailed plans showing the device, and it does show a 12.2-inch screen measuring physical dimensions of 12 inches by 8.7 inches by 0.28 inches thick, so just slightly thicker than the iPhone 6. And if you remember, earlier rumors were kind of pointing to more of a 13-inch, a 12.9-inch display on the iPad Pro, although more recent leaks seem to indicate that Apple's going slightly smaller, more in this 12.2-inch size. So this latest schematic does kind of jive with that. Also in the report, They note that the Air Plus will contain a next-generation Apple A9 processor. Now, this is the first time we've heard about the A9. Earlier reports believed that if Apple came out with a larger iPad, they would be using the A8X processor that they just released for the new iPad Air 2. So there's that that's new. And then lastly, something new in this leak is that the design shows four speaker placements, two on the top and two on the bottom. And this is reportedly to allow for improved stereo sound, meaning that you could pretty much have that iPad in any orientation and get good stereo sound. Now, one thing that I'm throwing on top of this is I have to wonder if Apple isn't going to leverage some of the knowledge of their, you know, Beats engineers that they acquired when they brought on Beats to kind of have a Beats or designed by Beats audio sort of tie-in. I don't think they would go so far as to, you know, putting any labels on the box or put a logo, you know, Beats logo on the back of the iPad. But I do have to wonder if, you know, in the bullet points when they announce the product, they'll say, and by the way, it has an all-new stereo speaker system, you know, designed and enhanced by our Beats technology. And that seems something that would be plausible. It's unclear now how tightly Apple is going to brand Apple and Beats together, if they're going to keep them separate. But I would think they would want to leverage sort of the success and the popularity of Beats, especially when they start to enhance and improve audio within their mobile devices. So something Apple's competitors have done, we haven't really seen Apple do that in the past. You know, maybe they'll just roll it in and give it some sort of Apple branding. So this is, you know, Apple-designed audio, and just leave the Beats thing behind altogether. That wasn't in the Mac fan rumor, but just something that I started thinking about when I started seeing this, you know, sort of four-speaker design in the Pro. And I guess the reason Apple would want to enhance the stereo in a Pro product is it would be targeted, I would assume, not only at artists and, you know, video and photography professionals, but also musicians, podcasters, folks like that who maybe want to take their production more on the road and use an iPad-style device for that. A lot of folks that are maybe using the MacBook Air at this point. And I still have this sort of hint of speculation that the 12-inch iPad and the 12-inch MacBook Air are kind of one and the same thing. I know a lot of folks think I'm a little bit crazy on this one, but I think Apple's looking to kind of merge those two product lines at some point in this next generation. It may make sense to do that. It may be further out than that, but I think at the very least they've probably been experimenting and playing around with that. And in addition to some of the new information about the iPad Air Plus in the Mac Fan Report, they are also suggesting that in addition to going big, Apple's also been working on their smaller iPad offerings. They're suggesting that Apple will debut an updated version of the iPad Mini, the iPad Mini 4, and that new update would feature an A8X processor bump in the smaller iPad, and that along with the release of the iPad Mini 4, Apple would discontinue sales of the iPad Mini 3 and also the iPad Mini, leaving just the 16-gigabyte iPad Mini 2 as the low-priced option. Now, this one, when I read it, seemed a little bit odd to me because I would think that Apple would want to keep Touch ID in the iPad lineup. I think moving forward, Apple ultimately wants to get Touch ID on all of their devices, and that would mean them sticking with the iPad Mini 3. I doubt they would take the iPad Mini 2 design and update that with a Touch ID sensor. But again, then you look at something like when Apple updated the iPhone, they kept around the iPhone 4S and the 5C, neither of which have Touch ID. So, you know, it could go either way on that one. I'd like to see them go more with keeping the Touch ID around, but we'll have to wait until that actually, you know, the release of these two new devices actually happens, if it actually does. And the report does claim that both of these tablets would launch sometime between April and June of 2015. So they're putting, you know, middle of the year kind of timeline. And that timeline would jive with a report from KGI securities analyst Ming-Chi Kuo that I think we talked about either last week or a couple weeks ago, where he claimed that the iPad Pro production had been pushed back until the second quarter of 2015. So expect to possibly see some iPad updates around mid-year. And if you've been waiting for that larger Pro model, that's when we may see it announced. No word on when it actually might ship. So, you know, this could be something that Apple could announce at something like a WWDC, something that would be of appeal to developers, especially if they need to develop sort of new pro-level apps or if there's going to be any new features in there that developers could take advantage of. But we're going to have to wait till mid-year to actually find out. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Now I want to talk about a story or a tip that we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast. I mentioned this really cool GitHub project that had a number of small little apps that you could install on your Mac for shutting down, restarting, locking, and sleeping your Mac. And I thought these were really cool for those of us who use Spotlight as an application launcher. I am a big fan of hitting Command plus the spacebar, typing out the first few letters of the app I want to launch, and then hitting Enter. I use Spotlight as my app launcher all the time. And so it was really cool because you could download these apps, you could install them on your Mac, and then quickly, if you wanted to sleep your Mac, you just hit Apple spacebar, start typing the word sleep, hit Enter, and your Mac will go straight to sleep. And a number of you pointed out, and I think rightly so, that there are already keyboard shortcuts for these built-in operations. But I think the difference here is that, you know, folks like me, I have trouble remembering these keyboard combos, and also I get confused sometimes as to which ones do what. So I'll go to try and maybe sleep my Mac, and suddenly I'm shutting it down. But for those of you who are curious and are more keyboard jockeys, you prefer to just keep your fingers on the keyboard and do keyboard shortcuts, there are quick ways to do display sleep, sleeping your Mac immediately. So if you want to do just sleeping the display, if you hit Control-Shift-Eject or Control-Shift and the power key, that will immediately put your display to sleep. If you want to sleep your Mac immediately without any kind of dialogue or anything like that, you can hit Command-Option-Eject or press the power button on your Mac, and that should put it directly to sleep. If you want to restart immediately without any kind of confirmation, Command-Control-Eject or Command-Control-Power will do that. Shutting down immediately, Command-Option-Control-Eject, and it will immediately shut down. Now, when I say immediately, I mean you're not going to get any warning. So if you hit that key combination, and this is one of the reasons I think I prefer using an app and, you know, the Spotlight launcher, is it's just going to shut your machine down. So if you're in the middle of working on something, you hit that wrong combo, that is going to happen. So make sure you remember these combos pretty well. If you want to be a little bit safer and still use a keyboard command, you can get the restart, sleep, or shutdown dialog by simply tapping Control plus Eject or Control plus Power or holding the power button down on your Mac for about 1.5 seconds. And then it'll pop up the dialog. It'll say, what do you want to do? Do you want to restart, shut down, or sleep? But then, of course, you've got to reach for the mouse or your trackpad and actually click on something. So, well, I guess you could use the, you know, keyboard key to select the proper option from the buttons. I think you hit R for restart, S for shutdown, et cetera, et cetera. But thanks to everyone who reminded me that we do have those keyboard shortcuts. But I think for me personally, I'm sticking with the little apps. Another thing that we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast was how to take screenshots, or we kind of covered screenshots. And it was because a question came up about how can I change, specifically in the Grab application, which is a dedicated application for taking screenshots, how can I change the format that it takes the screenshot in? I think by default, the Grab application uses the TIFF file format. And unfortunately, with Grab, there wasn't a way to actually change the file format. But I did discuss the built-in screen capture commands, Command-Shift-3, which will take a screenshot of your entire screen, and Command-Shift-4, which gives you options for doing different selections or selecting areas of the screen to take a screenshot. And when you do that, it drops those images on the desktop. And I believe the default file format, I want to say, is, I can't even remember anymore because I've changed it. It's PDF, and that's what we were talking about in that last episode, right? Was that in the past on the Mac, there was a terminal command you could go in and you could enter, and it would change the default file format for that screenshot capability that's built into Mac OS X. Now, that didn't work for Grab. It did work for Mac OS X Mavericks and earlier, but it no longer seems to work for OS X Yosemite. So that sort of left us with this dilemma of, well, if I'm running Yosemite, how can I change the file format? And my workaround, if you remember in that episode, was to use Preview. And I didn't know about this. You can actually go into Preview, and under the File menu, there is a Take Screenshot option. And that will take a screenshot and then automatically set it up as a new preview document. And then when you go to save from preview, you can pick whatever file format you want. So TIFF, PNG, JPEG, or PDF. Well, as a follow-up, Frank wrote in this week to give another handy tip, and I did not know about this. If you're using the built-in screenshot screen capture capability in Mac OS X, that's hitting Command-Shift-3 or Command-Shift-4, if you just add the control key into that, so you say Control-Shift-Command-3 or Control-Shift-Command-4, this will cause you to capture the screen and have it be copied to the clipboard rather than saving it to a file on the desktop. And so once you have it in the clipboard, you can open up Preview. Under the File menu, choose New from Clipboard. That will set up a new preview document with the contents of your clipboard. And then what you can do is you can just, again, save your preview document into whatever format you'd like, TIFF, PNG, JPEG, or PDF. Of course, the other option you have is you could also just simply copy or paste your screenshot into another app like Mail or Pages. Or I guess you don't have to copy it because it's already on your clipboard, right? So if you just add in the control key to the Shift-Command-3 or Shift-Command-4 options, it will actually put your screenshot right on the clipboard. And I thought that was pretty cool, and I didn't know about that one. So thanks, Frank, for sharing that with us. And since Frank gave us such a great tip, I thought it only fair that we help him out with a question that he had regarding OS X Yosemite and Mail. And what was happening to Frank, and this actually happened to me too. I didn't realize I had this problem until Frank sent me the email. But he was having some issues with built-in search. And so in Mail, when you start doing a search, what you typically get is a filtered drop-down. So you start typing in, say, someone's name, and it will show you the lists of people with that name who have sent you mail. And you can filter in, and you can start looking at just searches on subject or maybe the message body or to or the from field, and you can kind of drill down. What was happening for him in Yosemite, though, is as you start to continue to type, it will weed out that criteria. So if you type to a point where you've typed in a name and it's no longer found, say, in the subject line, it will no longer give you subject as one of those filter criteria. It'll just show you to and from. And the further you keep typing, the more and more this gets drilled down to nothing. And so what was happening to Frank was he would notice if he started to type a word like Frank, for example, just a name, when he hit the F, he would have all the options. But by the time he got out to typing out the full name, Frank, if he didn't have anybody in the to or from field with the name Frank, there were no additional options, and the search wasn't returning any results at all. So what it seemed like was that it was not giving the option to search the entire contents of a message. And in the past, in OS X Mavericks, when you would do that search and you would get the little filter drop down, one of the options was always message contains, I believe, or something like that, or search entire contents of the message. That was not working or has not been working for Frank. And I tried this on my own copy of OS X Yosemite in Mail, and I was having exactly the same issue, Frank. So I was really baffled by this. What I did discover is that as a workaround, I could use search tokens in the default Finder search. So if you go into Finder, hit Command F, and then start doing a search by saying where the kind colon is mail. So you type kind colon in the word mail, that'll filter your spotlight results to be just things that are in mail or just mail messages. And then after that, if you type the search token contains colon and then the thing that you're searching for, it will search through the bodies of all of your emails to find search results. And that was working for me, but nothing else. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. It really felt to Frank and myself that Apple had broken mail search. And so I complained about it on Twitter, and I actually posted to Twitter, wanted to know if other folks were having this issue. And listener Kevin came through for us because he pointed me to a discussion thread on Apple's discussion boards, and I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, that indicated this issue is actually not new to Yosemite, has maybe been around for a while and can plague users from time to time. So this, you know, a lot of folks on Twitter were saying, hey, search is working fine for me in mail. I don't get what your problem is. And so it looks like the issue might lie with the spotlight or mail indexes, and those somehow becoming corrupt. So for me, like Frank, the issue manifested itself, only manifested itself after upgrading to OS 10 Yosemite. So I jumped to the conclusion, oh, this is a Yosemite problem. I don't really think it is. And there's many fixes offered up, and I'm not really sure which one worked for me because I tried several of them, but I thought it'd be worth going over them because the fix does seem to be different for different people. And, you know, the root cause may be one thing or another. So I'll offer up as many possible fixes as I can, and hopefully one of these will work for you. I think the one that worked for me was simply re-indexing Spotlight. Now, typically the way I would do this is I would go into System Preferences, into Spotlight, into the Privacy tab, and then just add my boot hard drive, my hard drive that has the Mail app on it and my home folder on it. And what that will do is that will cause Spotlight to remove the Spotlight index. And then what you do after immediately adding it to Privacy is then just remove it back out. And that should force a entire Spotlight reindex. Now, when I did that, that did not seem to fix my Mail issue. So there is kind of the more forceful route that you can use, which is actually issuing a terminal command. So you can go into terminal and there's a special command you can issue, and I'll have it in the show notes at maccast.com. But once you do that, it will actually forcibly delete the Spotlight index, which then causes Spotlight to actually rebuild its index. And that did seem to work for me. Once I did that, then I was able to do searches in Mail and results were coming up as I would have expected. If that doesn't work for you, another fix is to simply rebuild the mailbox in Mail. So when you're in the Mail app, you can go select a mailbox and then under the mailbox menu, choose rebuild mailbox, and it will rebuild just that individual mailbox. Now, you would have to do that for all of the mailboxes that you are having trouble searching, I think, for this fix to work, but that's worth a shot. And then if that doesn't work, some users in the discussion thread, and again, I have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, so you can read through all of these fixes, but they suggested reindexing just the relevant folders in the Mail libraries. So in OS X, if you go into your home folder, into the library folder, into the Mail folder, into the V2 folder, what you'll see is you'll see all of your mailboxes in there. And there is a command that you can issue in the terminal to force those to actually rebuild and re-index themselves. And so you basically run this command, you point it to the folder you want to re-index, and it will re-index that. I did do that as well, so that might have been part of my fix, but it seemed like once I did just one folder, I just did my Gmail inbox, for example, suddenly all of the searches started working, and I had done the Spotlight rebuild prior to that. So I really think it was the Spotlight rebuild that worked for me. But if rebuilding individual mailboxes does not work for you, or reindexing individual mailboxes does not work for you, then the final thing to try would be a complete reindex of all of the envelope files. So basically reindexing everything in the Mail data folder. And then once you do that, you do have to go into that V2 folder. There's a Mail data folder, and you delete every file that begins with the words envelope index. There typically should be three of them, and there may be more if there's some older undeleted temporary files, something like that, but you delete those, and then you restart Mail, and then I think it pops up, and it looks like the first time that you launch Mail after upgrading, right? It says, do you want to upgrade your mailboxes, or it brings up some sort of dialogue. You say, okay. And then it will start to pull in and completely re-index your entire Mail library. So all of your folders and things like that. I would do this as a last ditch effort because it does take quite a bit of time. I think when I tried this fix, and this fix did not work for me. It's one of the ones that I tried first, and I wouldn't recommend trying it first. I'd save it to last. I tried it first and I had to re-index hundreds of thousands of emails, and it took quite a bit of time. But just a word of warning, all of these fixes, quote unquote fixes, have the potential for failure or to cause problems. So for sure, and I probably should have said this earlier, before you try any of them, make sure that you have all of your email files backed up, before you even attempt doing any of this stuff. But Frank, hopefully one of these fixes works for you. And my suspicion is that simply reindexing Spotlight would be the thing that gets it done for you as well. So it doesn't sound like this is one of the many Yosemite bugs that have plagued several users. It's been around for a while, and hopefully one of these potential fixes helps you out. On the November 9th show, I had the developers from Diddy Labs on. They are a couple guys I know here from San Diego who started up a company to develop iOS apps, and they do both their own apps and also develop apps for other people, do kind of contract work. And I wanted to talk to them because I get asked a lot about the whole experience of becoming a developer. A lot of you are curious about iOS development. How does it work? How do you become a developer? All those sorts of things. And I wasn't really planning on, you know, turning this into any kind of regular segment or anything. It was just something that, you know, came about as I was at my user group with these guys and we were talking about what they do. And I thought it would make an interesting story. Well, I didn't take the thought much further than that, but it makes sense that there's probably some other interesting stories out there. And luckily, Paul was kind enough to send along and share his personal iOS development story with us.
Hi, Adam. Paul here, talking to you from Galway on the west coast of Ireland. Let me start by saying that I'm a great fan of the show. I listen to you every Thursday on my journey back from Dublin to Galway. I've been following the podcast for only the last 18 months, but I must say it makes my two-hour car journey every week shorter and a lot more enjoyable. Anyway, I was listening last week with even greater interest than usual when you started talking about app developers. You covered two guys who set up their own company and went all in. I must say I was impressed with their courage. Then I thought that I should contact you and let you know my personal journey to becoming an Apple developer. So just a bit of background on myself. I finished college well over 20 years ago when I graduated as an electrical engineer. I had done a small amount of programming in Fortran and Pascal as part of the college course. C was only just emerging at the time, and I remember trying to pick it up from a book just after I finished college. Anyway, I joined the electricity utility here in Ireland and worked in some great jobs over the years. I have over 20 years service with them, and I'm probably a lifer with them. I worked in various technical managerial roles with the company during this period. About 4 years ago, I found myself working in the HR department and not getting job satisfaction out of it. So I began to look for something to make life a bit more interesting for myself. So all this time, I'm a mad Apple fanboy. I had followed the iMac, the iPod, and iPhone as they came out from the keynotes. I then decided that I would like to start developing for the iPhone. I mean, like, how hard can this be? I started an online course for Cocoa Touch, and I think then after about 25 minutes of the first lecture, I realized that I'd have to learn Objective-C first. So I went and bought the Apris book, the one with the fruit on the front. I then realized that I'd have to relearn a little, what little I knew about C before I could even go at that book. So I started reading the books with the fruits on the front. C, first of all, then Objective-C, and then Cocoa for the Mac. This wasn't fast. It took me a year to get through all three books. After that, I was finally up to speed enough to take Paul Hegarty's iTunes U Stanford University course on iOS. His classes were fantastic and his exercises were right on the mark. And as this was an iTunes U, it was free. And here I was, half a world away from Stanford and attending weekly lectures while still in my job, not being happy in HR. So I spent a lot of time wrecking my brain trying to figure out this great language that Paul Hegarty was teaching. Anyway, by the end of his course, I had done exercises on core data and animation, along with a host of other frameworks. I wrote an app so that I could use at work for finding transformers, and I wrote my own version of Boggle, just for myself. Then I decided I should set myself the personal goal of becoming a proper iPhone developer. I wanted to develop an original app and sell it on the App Store. After all this work, I mean, how much harder could it be? The only idea I had was these letters floating and bobbing along in some water. So I started animating letters across the screen, learning about gesture recognition and trying to add video and sound effects into the mix. The website Stack Overflow became my encyclopedia. The game began to form in my mind, but then I realized that a game requires graphics, and I was a programmer, not a graphic designer. Luckily, my wife does some graphic design, so I persuaded her to draw up some pictures for me. I also realized that I was a programmer and not a gamer. I suddenly had to figure out levels and scoring methods. Anyway, I use my children as a focus group, and boy, can your own children be tough in their reviews. Anyway, as a result of their comments, I had to learn how to add Game Center integration. Last year, I finally submitted my app to Apple. It took 3 attempts and 3 weeks to finally get it accepted. This was, I think, the proudest moment for me. My app, Peakspell, was finally out in the wild. This was the opportunity to make a fortune from my developing. I only needed to put the app in the store and the rest would magically happen. At the time, it was literally 1 in 1,000,000. I sent out an email to a few friends and family members telling them I had released the game. I discovered that I am a programmer and not a marketing person. The game was priced at a reasonable 99 cent, so it wasn't going to bankrupt anyone. I was amazed that of all my friends and family that I sent the email to, a good deal less than half purchased the app. I became disheartened after this. If only half the people I knew were willing to fork out 99 cents, what chance had I with people I didn't know? So I ended up not ever marketing my app. My own 16-year-old daughter refused to buy the app because she just doesn't buy apps. Everyone said to me, make it free. So I said, okay, I'll go down the freemium route, and had to learn how to introduce the iAd version of the app. I know you don't approve of this, but I had decided that people won't pay for apps. This meant that I had to learn how to integrate iAd into the app. More learning for me. I was proud of the fact that the free app used exactly the same code as the full app, with just one Boolean variable flipped before compiling. I guess that's the engineer in me. Anyway, to tell you how well I did, my sales of Peakspell plateaued at 34. My daughter still won't buy it. That means revenue for me of just over 20 euro. The free version got well over 100 downloads, mostly in countries, though, where iAd isn't running. China, the Philippines, and South Korea were strong downloaders. I felt at the time that these were just other developers checking out my app to see if it could be easily copied. My advertising income from the free game, Peakspell Lite, is close to 1 euro at the moment. Aside from the week before I released it, it was never going to be the app that made me rich, which was really a personal journey for me. And I did have a fantastic time developing it. On the work front, I told everyone in my HR department that I'd written the app. Again, hardly anyone bought it. But my company decided to develop apps for its workforce, and would you believe that because I had been telling them about my app, they asked me to go and join their new project. So I'm now helping the company roll out over 300 iPhones to some of its workforce and helping develop the company's first app designed specifically for iPhone. After all this personal journey, my own company found me. So, the future for me? Well, Apple has now set me 2 new challenges. They've changed the way storyboards are set up in Xcode with auto layouts and segues, and they've introduced a totally new programming language in Swift. I have an idea for another game now that I think I will probably develop. I won't be in it for the money. It's all about the journey. And I mean, like, how hard can it be? Anyway, that's my story. Adam, keep up the work with the podcast. Thanks for listening.
Hey, thanks, Paul. Thanks for sharing that story. I think, you know, there's a lot of us that reach that point in our lives, right? You're going along, you're doing something. You maybe like it, maybe you don't like it. Things have changed, but you're looking for something else. You're looking for something a little bit more. It's one of the ways that I started the podcast, and I think a lot of developers, iOS developers, find themselves in that place. And I think you kind of learned along your journey the thing that's most important is to kind of do this thing that you love, and very often the revenue or the money or the job will find its way to you. So it didn't work out for you, it sounds like, with the app sales, but you did learn some things, and the fact that you were able to further your career and transition that into maybe a position that you're happier with is a really cool thing. And I think for those of us who are motivated enough to go out there and sort of learn something new or try something new, I think almost always what you learn is that it's the journey is worth the sort of effort, that there is a reward in just doing, in just trying something. And I think the key, too, is to maybe not always go in with the reward in mind and not to think about that, but to sort of do and make and create and see where it takes you. The very worst thing that happens, I think, is that you learn something along the way. The best thing that can happen is there's some sort of financial benefit or some sort of emotional benefit that comes out of it. And luckily, it sounds like you discovered both in a way with furthering your career. And I wish you the best of luck in sort of taking the next step and taking it to the next level. I always, you know, like learning new skills and allowing those skills to sort of bring up new opportunities. And they don't always come up in the way that you think. I think many times they come up in much more surprising ways. You know, getting back to the MacCast, I started this out because it was something that I wanted to hear and I wanted to listen to, and it wasn't being created. So I decided to create it, and I've reaped huge benefits in many, many ways, from making new friends to actually being able to ultimately turn it into a career. It didn't happen overnight, but I kept at it and I kept trying and I kept iterating and I kept doing. And that's where I ended up. And I have a feeling your story resonates with a lot of other folks, as well as I'm sure there's developers out there that have shared your stories. I know people in my iOS group that said, you know, I was doing another job, I taught myself iOS programming, and I landed a new job, or I ended up in a different place in my company. I'm now in, you know, the IT department building apps for our Salesforce or what have you. And those opportunities are certainly out there, and I think they're only growing. So I would encourage anyone, it does not take a lot of effort. I know you joked, how hard can it be? It's hard, and learning anything is hard. But at the same time, we're at a time when the access to that information, you mentioned that Stanford course, or just books and materials, or even the internet, the access to the ability to learn that stuff is easier than ever. So all you have to do is have the effort and the drive and the passion to jump in and do it and get it done. It's not necessarily going to be easy. It's not necessarily going to reap immediate rewards. But again, I think the satisfaction of having learned something new and the long-term potential of, you know, a benefit from that are well worth embarking on the journey. So I appreciate you sharing your story. Again, I don't know if this is going to be a regular segment. I'm sure you may have a story like Paul's or like the guys at Diddy Labs. And if you'd like to share it with us, record up a quick audio comment and send it along. I'd love to listen. I don't guarantee that we're going to always play them on the show or share them, but I do find these stories interesting. And if you don't have your own story but like listening to these, let me know. Maybe we'll try and do a little bit more from time to time if it's something that you enjoy listening to, because I think they're great and fascinating, and I love hearing about how people sort of work and think and develop and grow and stuff like that. I think it's fun to share that stuff, because I think we all kind of can relate to that stuff in one form or another. I think probably the most frequent bug that I've heard plaguing people with OS X Yosemite is the one that we mentioned earlier. It's the networking bug, where suddenly your Wi-Fi connection just disappears, goes away, or slows down incredibly. But one bug came up this week that I thought was pretty interesting. And since I haven't upgraded fully, I wasn't really aware of this bug or affected by it, but I guess it has plagued some OS X Yosemite users. And so in case you've run across it and been baffled, I wanted to share this tip with you. The bug is in the save sheet dialog that comes down when you save a document in an OS X application. And apparently what can happen is the length of that sheet can grow over time to the point where it extends down below the bottom of your screen, and you can't resize it. There's no way to get it back. And this was actually talked about by Jason Snell over on his blog. This is where I saw the article. It's his Six Colors blog. And he revealed some of the details about why this is happening and offered up a fix for it. So what Jason learned was from the developer at St. Clair Software. These are the folks that make Default Folder X. And they explained that what happened was in OS X Yosemite, Apple changed the file dialogs so that the title bar is now considered to be part of the window. And that bar is 22 pixels high. But the trouble with the save sheet appears to be that Apple changed the math everywhere within the operating system to account for this extra 22 pixels, except for in the save sheet. So now each time you use the save function in an app, it will grow the length of that sheet by 22 pixels. So if you're saving a lot, you can see how eventually this will just get larger and larger and kind of move down the page, move down the page, move down the page. So one fix apparently is to reset the size setting in the app's preferences so that it resets the size of the share sheet back to the default. And then I would assume it starts to grow again and you'd have to run the fix again. But the fix, which is listed out in Jason's blog, and again, I'll have the link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, but I also put in the show notes, is to run a little terminal command. And basically, you run the command, it will go in and edit the defaults file for that app and reset the expanded panel size and the expanded size for the save mode, kind of reset everything back to normal. And within the command, you'll notice if you go look at it, you're going to have to replace the thing that says app name or the app name with the app that you're trying to implement the fix for. So for example, in Jason's example, it was BB Edit. So you'd have to put in BB Edit for the app name and then run these two little terminal commands. But he also updated the article just a couple days ago, and there's actually an easier non-terminal hack way of actually resizing that sheet. So while it doesn't appear that you can actually reach down and grab the handle at the bottom because it's shifted off the screen, Daniel Erickson noted that if you hold down the shift key while dragging the edge of the panel inward, because the save sheet is constrained, when you hold down the shift key and drag, what normally happens is it resizes from both sides. But in this case, since it can't resize the edge, it will bring the bottom back up. So it can actually bring it back up because there's no room for the actual panel to get narrower. And actually, if you're resizing windows in the Finder, this trick works as well. If you grab the handle and hold the shift key down and resize your window, what you'll notice is it resizes both sides, the side and the bottom. And if you hold option shift, it actually resizes from the middle, even though you're grabbing the edge of a window. So that's another little tip kind of related to this fix. So you can play around with those in the Finder for actually resizing your Finder windows. But that seems a little bit easier than running the terminal command, but I wanted to make sure that I covered both fixes for you in case you've been impacted by this. And a big thanks to Jason for writing that up, because had I run across this one, I would have been totally baffled. One of the trends that I've noticed in my usage of Macs and iPads and iOS devices and things like that recently, or in the past probably 5 years or so, is I've slowly transitioned away from using word processing documents and page layout documents, things like Pages and Word, into simply using text files for a lot of the work that I do. And I think a lot of us are moving to that sort of workflow because text files are completely ubiquitous. If you write something in a text file, you can take it from one application to another and you don't have a lot of issues. And especially if you don't need a lot of formatting, you can get by with, say, things like Markdown. So I am a big Markdown fan now because of the portability it offers on my documents. You know, occasionally I do need formatted documents and I jump back into Pages, but more and more, all of my documents live and exist inside a text editor. And Brad sent me a voicemail and let me know he's a text edit user almost exclusively. And he's also an iCloud user. So he's using documents in the cloud or iCloud documents to actually save his files from text edit up into iCloud. And he noted, while this works great when you're using multiple Macs because everything syncs across, so you can move from one Mac to another, go into text edit, go into the iCloud dialog and the open dialog, and then just read in, edit, and change those documents, and everything syncs back and forth. The problem is that there is no equivalent version of text edit on iOS. We've been hearing rumors that Apple might add text edit at some point, but right now we don't have that application. And so Brad was asking, how can I use text edit on my Mac, still use iCloud and have access to all of my files, keeping everything in sync so that when I'm on mobile, I can actually work with my text documents, edit them, and things like that. But the problem is that with iCloud on the Mac, what happens is when you save that file in TextEdit, it goes into that TextEdit folder, right? And unless an application on iOS has access to that folder, you're really stuck. You're not going to be able to get at it. So the solution, Brad, really would be to move those files or save your TextEdit files into some other location, some other iCloud location, and probably the iCloud app running on iOS 8 that you want to use to work with text documents. I guess in a way there would be kind of a workaround in OS 10 Yosemite using iCloud Drive, but if you're still on Mavericks, that's a little bit tricky to do, right? Because in Mavericks, what happens is all of your iCloud files are kept separate from within the app's open save dialog box, and you really can't get at them in the Finder on the Mac, at least not easily. You absolutely could find them if you go into your home folder, library folder, into the mobile documents folder under OS X Mavericks. You could find the folder for TextEdit, and you could maybe make an alias of that, or actually more importantly, probably what you want to find is the folder for your iOS text editing app. So be that, I don't know, Byword or Textastic, you could find that folder in the mobile documents folder, make an alias to it, and then when you're working in TextEdit, you could save into that document. Big hassle. Well, Apple kind of realized that, and so in OS X Yosemite, they made things a little bit easier because we have iCloud Drive. So if you're running Yosemite, what I would think you would want to do is use the iCloud Drive for whatever iOS application you want to work with your text documents in, because iCloud Drive is now accessible from any Finder window. If you don't see it, make sure you go into the, you know, while you're in the Finder, go into the Finder menu, go into Preferences, and click on the sidebar tab and make sure that the iCloud Drive is checked. And so once that's checked, you can go in iCloud Drive and you can see that all of your iOS or Mac iCloud Drive documents are associated with whatever application created them. So there'll be a folder for TextEdit. There'll be a folder for, say, like Byword or Textastic or whatever your preferred text editor is on iOS. And so what you could do is simply move your TextEdit documents from the TextEdit iCloud Drive over into the one for iOS. And then I would say moving forward, when you're working in TextEdit on your Mac, you don't have to get a different text editor on your Mac. But when you're working in TextEdit, when you go to this open save dialog box, just go over to iCloud Drive, find the iOS application that you want to use, and open your text documents from there. And that way, they'll always stay in sync with whatever editor you want to use on iOS. And I think that's really probably the easiest way to do it, because then when you get into your iOS app, you just open it up, you go to the iCloud for that app, and you'll see your text file right there. So my preferred editor is Byword. That's the one I use most frequently. The only thing you have to be careful about with there, and actually you would have to do this for any iOS editors that you're using, is that many of them don't have rich text format support. So if when you're working in TextEdit, you're saving to RTF files, make sure that you pick an iOS application that can open and edit RTF files. A lot of them only work with TXT files. Or if you're working in TextEdit and want to just save as text files, make sure that you're going under the format options and setting your format to text only. The good news is that if you're looking for a text editor on iOS, there is a great resource. Brett Terpstra has this extensive list of editors, and his page of iOS text editors has this awesome feature table that shows you which ones support iCloud Drive, which ones support which file formats, all kinds of different features and things like that. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at madcast.com so you can find it. But of course, you're going to want to make sure that yours supports iCloud Drive and probably RTF file formats. And if anybody has a recommendation for a good iOS text editor that supports RTF, let me know. I kind of went through Brett's list. There wasn't a lot of options, and I don't know much about the specific editors that are listed. So if you have one that you particularly like and work with, shoot me an email, madcast@gmail.com, and I'll try and mention that on the next episode of the MadCast. Of course, Brad, if you want to just abandon iCloud, all of this could be a little bit simpler. And I think, you know, that's the approach that I took, is I just save all of my text documents and files in a service like Dropbox, or you could use Box.net, something that integrates with your favorite iOS editor, and then just save them there. And that could avoid the problem altogether. So again, you could still work in TextEdit on your Mac, save to your Dropbox folder, and then from your iOS applications, just open up those documents from Dropbox, and it makes it a little bit easier. And that's what Apple's trying to sort of move to with the whole iCloud Drive concept. You can sort of treat it similarly to Dropbox if you don't want to kind of sign up for a different service. But really, the choice is yours, and I hope that gives you a couple of ideas and options to work with. And then the last thing that I have for you today is a little iTunes thing. Andy sent me a voicemail because he encountered a little bit of trouble in keeping his music library on iOS 8 clean. And what I mean by that is that Andy is like me. He's an iTunes Music Match customer and absolutely loves it. I'm a big fan of iTunes Music Match because it means I don't have to sync all of my music to my iOS devices. So it allows me to keep my music library small, very selective in terms of just the things that I want to have downloaded and in my music library, keeps it nice and tidy, and I don't have to worry about my storage space. And Andy is just like me and enjoys that kind of benefit of being an iTunes Music Match customer or subscriber. But the problem with Music Match that has been accentuated by the iOS 8 update is that for non-downloaded matched music, you can go into your music library and you can play that stuff and it quote-unquote streams the music. But the thing is that Apple's version or idea of streaming is not what most of us think of as streaming. It's not the typical way of streaming. What they're actually really doing is a progressive download. So they start downloading the file and then start playing it as it downloads. And then they store that file in this cached kind of secret area on the device. And it's sort of marked as, you know, you can use this area if you need space, but we're going to fill up this space the more and more you stream music. So the music app is aware of where that music is and how to get to it, but you really don't have a way within the app to see it and manage it. And I kind of take that back because you can actually see it, but you really can't manage it. So to kind of see the effects of this, if you're an iTunes Match subscriber or Music Match subscriber, is go in to your into the music app, stream a song, and then after you've done that, make sure you go into the settings and music settings on your iOS device and turn off the show all music option. So what that means is that it's going to hide any music that's in the cloud and only show you the music that is in, you know, and stored in the music app. So presumably this would be the stuff that you deliberately clicked the iTunes cloud icon and downloaded to your device. But once you've streamed some songs with iTunes Music Match and you go back into the music app, what you'll see is that song that you quote-unquote streamed is actually there and shows up. And worse, the typical action of being able to swipe across that track and delete it and remove it from your library doesn't work. That option only appears if it's music you deliberately downloaded from iTunes in the cloud. And so you can delete music, you know, music manually downloaded, but you cannot delete the quote-unquote stream stuff. And this was the thing that was driving Andy crazy, right? Because he'd stream a bunch of music, and then suddenly his music library would be filled up with all of this content when he wasn't connected to the internet, when he didn't have a connection. He'd have all this extra content that he really didn't want there. And in the past, prior to iOS 8, so the way this got worse in iOS 8 is in the past, you could actually go into settings on your iOS device, go under general, into the usage, and then tap on the manage storage option. And then within there, tap on the music category, and there was a delete all music. And this would actually purge and delete all of your downloaded music. So whether it was stuff that you streamed from iTunes Music Match or stuff that you had already downloaded, it would kind of reset things, and then you could go back in and just download the specific albums or tracks that you actually wanted stored on your device. But for whatever reason, Apple seems to have removed this functionality in iOS 8. So the question becomes, how can we keep the music library clean? How can we kind of reset things so that I'm not seeing all of this streamed, progressively downloaded, cached music on my device. And Andy, the only possible solution that I have found was to actually go into settings, into music, and temporarily turn off iTunes Match, and then just simply turn it back on. And for me, that seemed to clean out most of my iTunes Match streamed cached files. Inexplicably for me, there were three tracks that were left behind. I have no idea why these specific three tracks, but they seem to be stuck in my device. I'm assuming I'm probably going to have to do a complete, like, erase and reinstall if I really want to get rid of those. They're not really bothering me too much, so I'm deciding to leave them there. But that was the only thing I could get to work for me. Now, you may have another tip or trick for Andy with how to kind of clean this stuff out. I wasn't able to find any while I was searching around. The only other possible workaround that I read about when I was looking into this is there are some Mac apps or Windows apps out there that I guess will let you go through and actually browse the kind of hidden storage areas on your iOS device while it's, you know, hooked up via the USB Lightning cable, and actually go in and manually delete those. And I don't think you have to do a jailbreak for those, but some of the applications that are recommended in the sites that I go to me seem a little odd. I guess is the polite way of putting it. Shady may be the other way of putting it. And I wasn't really comfortable with running or installing any of these apps, just because I don't know what they're doing, and they seem like they're from some kind of unknown or out there developers. And the one app that I prefer to use, iPhone View from Ecamm, doesn't give you visibility into the area where the music is stored. So definitely open for other ideas. If you have a suggestion for me or Andy, send along a recommendation or an email, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the show for today. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, and Disk Label. Also, Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, as well as PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find out more information and details on all of their software by going to smilesoftware.com. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, and other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you learn and keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, or explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. MacCast listeners can get a free trial by going to lynda.com/MacCast. That's lynda.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the show is handled by Backbeat Media. They're at backbeatmedia.com. Don't forget, we are doing a giveaway with the folks at Orbotics, makers of the Sphero and the new Ollie. I absolutely love my new Ollie. These are an iPhone-controlled ball, and the Ollie is kind of like this tube with nubby tires on either end, and you can actually get new tires and rims and stuff like that, but you control it all with your iPhone or your iPad, and the Ollie can do all kinds of tricks and flips, and the Sphero, the new 2.0 version, is absolutely incredible. And the folks at Orbotics reached out to me, and they're letting me give away to MacCast listeners an Ollie, including a new dark side Ollie. So we've got an Ollie, a dark side Ollie, and a Sphero, one for three different people. You're not going to get all of them, but we're giving away three Orbotics products, and it is open to anyone who's a MacCast listener. So all you have to do is head to gosphero.com/MacCast-giveaway. That's gosphero.com/MacCast-giveaway, and sign up before midnight Eastern time on December 4th, and you'll be entered to win that, and you will be notified a few days later if you've won one of those great Sphero products. So sign up for that. But with that, that is going to do it for the show. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. And if you need show notes with links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online between shows, I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can also check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And we also have a Google Plus community. Just search for MacCast on Google Plus, and you will find us hanging out there. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.